Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week was born in India and was raised in Washington, D.C. He earned a specialty degree in neurological surgery from the University of Virginia. In 2013, he started his own neurological surgery practice from scratch and made only $300 the first few months. Today, he performs an estimated 600 surgeries a year on the back, spine, head, and/or brain. His name, Dr. J. Jagannathan, and we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible, a News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're with the most amazing young doctor, Dr. J. Jagannathan, who in 2013 started his own neurological surgery practice. Doctor, welcome. Real honor to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Can we start to talk about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Sure. Like many in the area, I was born in India. My parents came here, like many others, to get their education. My dad initially came to do his PhD in economics at Boston University. And my mom followed, originally more as support for my dad, but ultimately ended up getting her master's degree and ultimately her PhD from BU. And my dad started his career in the Indian government. It was called the Indian Administrative Service. So he had a good job back there, and I think their original plan was actually to go back. So when they initially came, I actually didn't come. I was 3 years old and stayed in India with my grandparents because they thought it would be too much of an adjustment for a brief period of time. But I think two things happened. One, you know, when you leave a young child, parents miss them, and so they started missing me, and obviously I assume I missed them too at that age. And I think more importantly, I think they started realizing there was a future here. Because of that, I came. My grandfather originally brought me here, and so I came when I was 3 years old, and the story that I heard was that when I first came, because I hadn't seen my parents, I think, in 6 months or a year, that I didn't recognize my mom or dad, and it upset them in the beginning, you know, because I had, you know, kids, your memories are so short. But so that's what kind of brought me here.
How was a doctor? You became a doctor. Your dad was an economist.
Yeah.
Your mom was in IT.
Yeah.
Why a doctor?
I think a couple of things. I always had an interest in science and technology. I knew that was going to be the area I was interested in. My undergraduate background was in electrical engineering, kind of following that kind of background. I knew that if I ended up being an engineer, it wouldn't be a theoretical engineer. I mean, I didn't really see myself in a lab, just sort of, you know, building up, you know, doing circuits or something like that. I'd want to do something that was more practical, and so I think. Surgery especially was kind of a logical choice for me. I think there was the dual dynamic of it. One is being able to interact with people and being able to I think the thing about neurosurgery in particular is you see the highest highs and the lowest lows. And the opportunity to sort of interact in both of those areas is unique. And that's one thing that really attracted me to medicine, combined with the fact that, you know, the ability to sort of use things like manual dexterity to be on the cutting edge of technology. And I think the nervous system is the last frontier. I think it's the area that we really don't understand. And it's an area very apropos right now because it's Brain Tumor Awareness Month. You know, if you look at malignant brain tumors, the average survival from the 1930s to today has only gone up in the magnitude of a few weeks. So with all the billions of dollars in technologies, with, you know, jets that can get you to Europe in 3 or 4 hours and all sorts of other stuff, we're not able to cure these types of common diseases that people suffer through. So I think for me it was a combination of early interests and then just the fact that I think it's a fascinating field.
In the Indian community culture and in the Chinese culture, education is huge. Why so?
I think it's I think there's a bit of a selection bias in the people that we see here, because most of the families that come, especially the first and second generations, many families, especially this day and age, have come for an education, or they come in a situation where they come from scratch and they have to rely on education in order to get them forward. I think, obviously, if you look at a place like India, the poverty line there or the average level of education for the average person is actually much less than the average in the United States. You know, I mean, we're able to get the majority of our, you know, kids are able to go to, have opportunity to go to school to read and write and things like that. In countries like India, they don't. So I think what happens is that there's a bit of a selection bias, and I think the people that come here typically come with an idea of expanding what they had in their life or improving it. And I think most people realize, or most parents, or most families realize that the way to do this is usually through an education, to expanding your horizons.
Your parents are heroes to you.
Yeah.
Also, another hero is Mother Teresa.
Yeah.
Why?
I think one of the things about medicine, I think it gets a positive and a negative rap at the same time. But I think one of the things that we all have to strive towards at the end of the day is towards selfless giving, to be able to give ourselves to our job and not expect much in return. And I think that's something we all strive to do, especially in this field, or I think we should strive. I think the people, in my opinion, that sort of get detoured from that overall goal are the ones that usually end up in my opinion, in non-ideal situations. And I think that's to me, is I think what I strive for in my career. At the end of the day, it's not about how much money you make, how busy you are. It's about how many people's lives you made a difference in, and how many people you can walk in the room and be able to say that, I trust you and I appreciate what you did for me.
Another hero, huge hero, is Gandhi. Please.
I think Gandhi, two main things about him. Obviously, the first thing that I think I really respect and I view in my own life and career is the ability to go against the grain and to take a chance and do something that may be viewed as unpopular in order for the greater good. And I think, obviously, in his case, the idea of, number one, of nonviolent resistance, and number two, of going against an empire, you know, that was probably larger than anything we have presently in politics or in government, you know, bigger than what we were talking about Russia when you're talking about the British Empire in the 40s. I think that took some real intestinal fortitude. That's something very many people couldn't do. And if you recall, you know, in spite of the fact that now he's viewed as an icon or a legend, at the time when he was alive, he was passed over for a Nobel Prize multiple times because, he wasn't he didn't meet the mold. He didn't fit the mold. And I think in our careers, I think that's a really important thing that we often have to do, especially in medicine. Sometimes it's a matter of doing what's right as opposed to doing what, you know, it just needs to be done because somebody says this is how we have to do things.
We're talking to Dr. J. Jagannathan, and I'm Jack Rasool, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Krasula, and we're with Dr. J. Jagannathan, who believes that the nervous system is the last frontier. Doctor, you did your residency, and then you worked in a university setting. Talk about that chapter in your life.
So I think the hardest thing in medicine is going from being a trainee to being actually practicing on your own. And the reason for that is because the magnitude of the decisions you make are so much more important. You know, I mean, you can perfect doing a procedure. You know, I mean, I could train my three-year-old son to do some surgical procedures that we do, and he probably would carry it off after a certain point with a certain degree of proficiency. But I think what separates a professional from someone who's not a professional is deciding when to do it and using your judgment in terms of deciding, when you see a patient who may not be where a surgery can be done on or a procedure can be done on, who may not be an ideal candidate. I'll give you an example. I saw a lady in my clinic about a week ago who had a terrible arm pain. I mean, just horrible pain. It had been bothering her for 8 or 9 years. She had done everything, physical therapy, pain management, that type of stuff. She had gone to a number of centers, very high-profile centers, and so she had come over to my clinic and was complaining of that. The only drawback, which is a great lady, I felt I really could help her, but she was 90 years old. And at the end of the day, I mean, I know technically I could do the surgery on her. I probably could help her feel better. But at age 90, I think the risks of doing a surgery like that, in my opinion, from a medical standpoint, in terms of the risks that she would go through and things like that, may not justify the actual the procedure, you know. At the end of the day, our job is first to do no harm. And so those are things that I think come with experience, you know, and some of it is trial and error. Some things, that you learn and you you adjust based on that. So I think an academic setting or a university hospital was good for me because it was a high-volume setting. I got to do a lot of surgery there. You were in a situation where you were training others, so you saw the thought process that others were going through as they evolved through their training process.
All right. Speaking of going on your own,
yeah.
2013, you make the leap.
Yeah.
How was it you decided to start your own practice?
You know, I had gotten married that year. My wife is from the area, and I think my original plans were always to go back home to the East Coast. And, you know, my wife had strong ties to the area. She had just finished law school and was interested in, you know, we had decided that we wanted to stay in the area. And obviously, I had worked in Michigan for 3 years at that point. So it was, you know, I already had some basic infrastructure in terms of setting up a practice. And I think, you know, there's always a leap between working for yourself and working for others, and that's always the hard part. Anytime you go to a job and you say, well, I would do this differently if I was on my own, or maybe I wouldn't have hired that person to do this job. And I think, you know, from my perspective, I felt that, this was sort of the time. I was young enough that, you know, if things didn't work out, I could still reset. You know, we didn't have kids at that point, which made a huge difference because I wasn't worrying about college, you know, savings and things like that. So we felt it was a good time, and we were willing to take that risk. And at the end of the day, it's you know, the hope that the things you've learned and the lessons you've learned, good and bad in life, are going to, you know, see you through in terms of making good decisions.
Soon after you started the first office,
yeah,
you then started an office in West Branch and one in Sault Ste. Marie,
yeah,
where you would fly up there to help people that couldn't get down here. Why did you decide to do that?
So the Northern Michigan part was interesting. A colleague of mine was practicing up in Northern Michigan and suffered a heart attack. And he had a practice, and he couldn't, he wasn't able to take care of his patients there because basically he was not in a position where he was fully able to work because he was still recovering. And he had asked me, he had said it was a good opportunity. He said that this would be a good place to go. And my initial feeling, honestly, there was it was going to be sort of a stopgap while I picked up volume here locally. That would be a good opportunity to sort of build up a little bit. But our volume grew, you know, probably grew at a rate that was double this rate that we were growing here just because of the need for neurosurgical care. And it got to a point where, it was just, we were doing so well there, and I think the patients there were such a pleasure to deal with that, that you know, I felt that this was really an integral part of my practice, and I decided to keep it going. And the expansion up to the Sioux happened, number one, because there is really no neurosurgical coverage in the Sioux. The closest is in the UP is from Marquette. And another colleague of mine, in neurosurgery, spine surgery, small, short, you know, tight-knit community, was living up there, was from there, and moved to California to take an academic position there. And he had asked me if I would be willing to take over his practice there, so we did that.
We're talking to Dr. Jay Jagannathan, and in many ways, at a very young age, he's very much like an old-school doctor of yesterday, flying into West Branch, Sault Ste. Marie, to take care of those who can't travel down to the Detroit area for surgery and treatment. Doctor, tell us about your practice today and your team of 22.
The goal of our practice at the end of the day with a private practice is to make ourselves as patient-centric as possible. I mean, our goal is to make sure that our patients are well taken care of and that our patients have access to the technology and the needs that they would have anywhere in the world. And I think in you know, for the pluses and minuses you hear about the healthcare system in the United States, the one positive thing we could say we have going for us is that, you know, whether you're a person off the streets of Detroit or you're the President of the United States of America, you are going to get something called the standard of care. And I think what makes us unique is that because of our staff, who are extremely well trained, because of our dedication of the people, the employees in the practice, we're able to provide that level of service to our patients in different locations. We have offices here in Metro Detroit, in Troy and Garden City. We have an office up in West Branch, which covers upper Lower Peninsula, and an office in Sault Ste. Marie. We have a local office staff who are based in the specific area of the office in those specific locations. So when patients pick up the phone and call, they're not talking to somebody in Detroit if they're up in the Sioux. They're talking to someone down, in locally, who can get answers right away. And ultimately, it boils down to responsiveness. We want to make sure that patients have their questions and needs addressed quickly. And I think one of the things with my staff and my office is that I think patients, we want to give the impression, and hopefully patients know, that if they have a question, it's not going to be something that a nurse is just going to, deal with over the phone. It's going to be something that they will, they'll call me or text me or talk to me in person about, and then we'll have an answer to them right away.
If you want to learn more, www.mi-neurosurgery.com. Doctor, you perform an estimated 600 procedures a year on the back, spine, head, and or brain, 70% on the spine, 30% on the brain. Talk about your culture that you've tried to give to the 22 people.
I think in my opinion, the type of business structure that works best is a flat structure. I think a real hierarchical structure where the doctor sits on top of a pyramid and everyone works under him, I think works in certain environments, maybe in an academic type of environment or maybe in a certain era, those are effective. I think in this day and age, I think it's so easy for patients to go on the internet or to look up stuff and do other things. We want to make sure information is easily accessible. So our goal is that, is to have an organizational structure where anyone, a medical assistant with, very minimal medical training, can come to me and ask me a question regarding a patient's concerns or queries, as much as a physician assistant or another neurosurgeon or another physician who may call me. And I think that's something we emphasize. I mean, I carry my phone on me 24/7. It rings, it texts all hours of the night. But I really think that responsiveness is critical, and that's what set us apart, when we compete with larger systems.
We're talking to Dr. Jay Jaganathan. When we come back, we're going to ask him about the miracle we call the brain. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasul, and we're Dr. Jay Jaganathan, who performs an estimated 600 procedures a year on the back, spine, head, and or brain. Doctor, tell us, if you will, about the miracle we call the brain.
The brain, as a lot of people call it, the seat of the soul, in terms of being able to sort of control everything that we do, not only the subconscious things like keeping your heart beating, keeping your breathing and things like that, but your decisions in life, your choices, your decision on who you're going to fall in love with, who you're going to marry, decisions on what you eat for dinner tonight. So I think at the end of the day, and not to sound a little bit too neurosurgical centric, but I think it is, in my opinion, the most fascinating and the most critical area in all of medicine, because I think it's one that controls, or at least has a major influence on how all the other areas function,
All right, another miracle, the human back.
Yeah. Well, back obviously is a conduit, is the area that sends signals from the brain to the rest of the body, I think unfortunately it's one of these things like with a lot of things in medicine that we don't really appreciate until it stops working or doesn't work as well, a lot of times when we see it, it's because of either problems, degenerative problems with the spine or with the nerves that prevent them from working, or things like cancer or things like that that affect the ability to from signals to get transmitted. And a lot of times those cause profoundly devastating consequences for patients.
Doctor, you told me when we had breakfast a few weeks ago that there's 120 types of brain tumors.
Yep. So brain tumors are, when people think about brain pathology, it's often the first thing they think about. Tumors, or maybe aneurysms is probably close number two. There are a wide variety of brain tumors. The ones we usually associate are the malignant ones, which, as I mentioned earlier, do tend to have extremely devastating consequences on people. Approximately 700,000 patients in the United States have brain tumors. There are about 70,000 that are diagnosed every year. So there's a substantial portion of the U.S. population that are going to be diagnosed. And, you know, the joke that I've heard, you know, I've heard among some radiologists is that you're only one MRI away from your brain tumor, because, you know, with the increasing prevalence of imaging modalities and the availability, they're getting diagnosed more and more often. Now, there are a lot of benign tumors and many tumors that don't even need to be treated. The ones that concern us, or the ones that I see on a more regular basis, are patients with malignant tumors. And those are really where I think most of the attention is needed right now, because the prognosis is so poor. You know, with malignant brain tumors, you're talking about a survival oftentimes of around 30%, sometimes less. The most common malignant tumor, glioblastoma, you're talking about a survival of well under a year, which, as I mentioned earlier, is not that much different than what it was in the 1930s or 1940s. And in spite of all the advances, in spite of our knowledge of the biology of these tumors, or, you know, being able to classify them into 120 types, there are less than five FDA-approved medications for brain tumors. So there's a lot of scope for development in that area.
I quote you now, the tumors are smarter than we are.
Yeah. So I think the what I meant by that is that the tumors are oftentimes able to evade treatment. You know, you have a lot of drugs for where patients are able to get temporary benefit, where it appears to work for a few weeks or a few months, but then the tumors are able to develop things like resistance mechanisms, like drug efflux mechanisms, and things like that that allow them to evade the use of standard chemotherapeutic agents. And part of that is because the biology of these tumors are so complex. I mean, you're talking about cells with hundreds of chromosomes in them that are constantly dividing much quicker than the rate of normal cells in the brain or other parts of the body. So I think being able to solve these tumors really is going to take a very, very detailed and very complex understanding of the biology of these systems. You know, it's less so than something like a simple surgical thing where you say, well, we have a problem here, we're just going to go take it out. You're dealing with a biological system that's constantly evolving, and you've got to keep up with its evolution, or at least understand why it's evolving the way it is in order to effectively treat it.
Three very prevalent words today. Dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's.
So these are called neurodegenerative disorders. They're disorders that involved degeneration or damage for a variety of reasons. A lot of these reasons we don't even know, in various parts of the brain. And the results of these are often problems with memory, problems with concentration, and in things like Parkinson's, problems with motor function, the ability to have normal coordination, balance, blood pressure, things like that. There are some promising treatments. Parkinson's especially, there's a treatment called deep brain stimulation, which involves stimulating certain parts of the brain to help compensate for other areas that may be slowed down. But things like dementia, we don't have as good treatments for. And, you know, and I think a lot of this, again, boils down to our understanding of a condition. You know, in order to treat it, you need a reason. You need something to be able to, an understanding of what exactly you're treating, you know. And I think that's where the importance of a better understanding of these problems. And honestly, that's what's fascinating about neurosurgery, is we're kind of at that interface, at that crux between the disease and, you know, seeing the patient and the science behind it, in terms of balancing the two and seeing where, you know, how we can help patients the best.
What, if anything, can I do to minimize the odds of my getting dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's?
I think there are several things. You know, obviously, as we mentioned earlier, the reasons for some of these diseases are not fully known, but I think in general, keeping in good general health is always a positive. You know, being able to stay active. As you get older, there is a tendency to develop some signs of dementia, just from the standpoint of age itself. And I think what they've shown is that being active mentally, being engaged in activities, even things like, you know, playing video games and playing memory games, games where you've got cues, are positive from the standpoint of keeping the brain working. And it's one of these things where I think the more you're actively engaged, the more you're involved in pursuits that interest you, and that you're able to keep the process of reflection and thought active, I think those are going to lower the chances, but not eliminate it altogether.
If you want to learn more, www.mi-neurosurgery.com. Doctor, another word, stem cells.
Yeah. So stem cells is an area, a controversial area that a lot of people talk about. You know, when we refer to it, we'd refer to immature cells that are able to go in and differentiate into whatever type of cells may be needed to cure diseases and do other things. We use stem cells actually fairly, not infrequently, in spinal fusions, for example, to help strengthen the bone when we have to shave off large portions of bone in cases of deformity or severe degeneration or scoliosis. And the results have been promising. I've had a number of patients who've had good results from them. The use of stem cells in areas like spinal cord injury and in terms of brain tumors and things like that are still relatively ambiguous. We don't really have solid data or in terms of solid trials that have really shown that these have made a consistent difference. But certainly the concept is a unique concept, and I think it's something that with further development will continue to play a role in medical care for these types of patients.
Stem cells and spinal cord injuries.
So stem cells' idea, again, is to take these different undifferentiated cells and to help them regenerate areas in the spine that are damaged. And one of the things with the nervous system in general is that, especially in adults, the nervous system, the central nervous system, doesn't heal itself quite as well as it does in children. And for some reason, for example, in children, I think we were talking about this during our breakfast, you can have a 18-month-old who has a major brain surgery where you take off half the visual cortex, and by the age of 3, they've got their vision is fine. And that's because there is what we call plasticity, meaning that the brain is able to remodel and different areas take over the roles of areas that don't work anymore. And for some reason, when we get older, we lose that ability, and nobody really understands why. And as you get older, you lose that ability to the point where it even affects you in terms of day-to-day. You know, that's why, you know, when you get senility or dementia as you get older, your brain is not even able to function at the baseline level that it was, you know, when patients are younger. So I think it has an immense amount of potential. Again, I think a lot of it, what it boils down to, particularly when it comes to spinal cord injury, you're talking about an acute injury, and then you're talking about events that happen after the injury, like swelling and inflammatory reactions within the spine that causes that injury to get worse. Now, our ability to manage the acute phase is actually not bad, you know, in terms of EMS transfer, immobilizing, putting patients in collars, decompressing the spine quickly. What we don't understand is how to manage it after the acute phase when this inflammatory cascade is going on. And I think what the current literature seems to be showing is that most of the damage that comes from spinal cord injury, even more so than the acute phase of the injury, is happening over the next 24 to 96 hours when all of these other changes are happening in the spine that are causing the injury to get worse.
Dr. J, what can we do to avoid or minimize back and spine problems as we get older?
So factors that play a role, probably the number one factor that I see in my office is going to be obesity. I think patients that are morbidly obese, for obvious reasons, they put more stress on their spine. They tend to have a higher incidence of back pain, and particularly in recent years with the reports on, you know, America in general becoming more obese, with obesity becoming a greater problem, that's going to be more and more of a problem. I think staying active is a major factor. I think that it's one of those things. The better your muscle tone is, the better your core strength is, the less likely you're going to have these types of problems. Smoking is a major factor that we see, and smoking, particularly for cervical spine, for the neck, there's been numerous, countless amount of data that's shown that smoking has a deleterious impact in terms of not only being related to disc degeneration, but also in terms of patients having worse outcomes after spinal surgery. So I would say those are three critical factors that are, many of them that are fairly modifiable, that can be done to help with pain.
We're talking to Dr. J. Jagannathan, and I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Dr. J. Jagannathan, who believes, and I quote him now, that neurological surgery is a humbling field.
I think neurosurgery is one of those fields where you can never, like I was mentioning to you earlier, I think you have the highest highs and the lowest lows, you know, and as high as you might get during your high points, you always realize that, you know, you're only that far away from a bad outcome where you feel that, you know, you always look back and say, what could I have done differently? And I think it's a field where you never get overconfident. It's a field where you always go into every case with the same degree of meticulousness and the same degree of organization. You know, I think during my training, one of my mentors used to compare it to fighting a battle. You know, if you go out in the battlefield for a war, you're never, no matter how many times you've been to war, you're not going to go in there and say that I've, you know, I'm just not going to prepare. I'm just going to go in and wing it, you know? And it's the same thing. The only difference is the battle that you're fighting doesn't just affect you. It affects someone else who's on the table there. And I think that's something that people have to be very cognizant of. And I think it's also something that people lose sight of. I read an article in the paper about a surgeon in Seattle a few months ago who. He had some adverse outcome, but the patient quoted him as when he walked in the room, he told the patient that I've done the surgery so many times I can do it with my eyes closed. Now, whether you've done it or not, that's a bad attitude to have when you're going in. And I could tell you that the times people, you know, when this is a type of field, whereas if you go in with that type of attitude, you will get stung a few times because there is a, I think there's always a force that's bigger than your own in terms of being able to predict outcomes. And we always try to do the best we can, but I think it's something where we have to be prepared and you have to have the humility.
I know a 90-year-old ex-plastic surgeon that was legendary at Beaumont. Mm-hmm. He now lives in Traverse City with his wife, Dr. Robert Poole.
Okay.
And he once told me, Jack, we cut, but God heals.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, our perspective or our position in the overall spectrum of the healing process is very small. You know, we do we see a patient for a few hours, we do surgery, we see them at multiple clinic visits afterwards, but there's a much bigger picture that's going on. I mean, you look at a patient with a spinal cord injury, you know, I think I mentioned I operated on one late last night, who comes in through the emergency room. They call me in the middle of the night, I do the surgery on him, I see him again this morning, and I keep seeing him. But for him, his life has changed. You know, his life has gone from a normal life where he runs a restaurant and has a normal function to being able to not being able to move anymore. And in that sense, you know, I think that's where we put ourselves into check in terms of our position in the overall scheme of things. Now, everyone who comes in the door, you know, has a certain preconceived notion about what their conditions are, and that includes a doctor. When you see a patient, you've seen others like this who, in similar conditions, and you want to say this is how this usually happens or that doesn't. But I think it's important at the end of the day to give every patient, every disease, the benefit of the doubt that its nature has to take its own course. So, you know, you see patients who have really bad malignant brain tumors sometimes, and they've gone to an oncologist who says, look, you've got 6 months left. And, you know, I think my general reaction to that is that I think we have to treat it as if, you know, we're going to do everything we can to help you. And then at the end of the day, we don't make the decisions when people live or die, whether someone walks or doesn't walk again. That's a decision that's made, you know, beyond our control. And our job is to do two things. One is to give patients the best possible care. And number two, to be the best facilitator and the best advocate for the patient possible.
Dr. J,
yep.
Do you believe in miracles, and have you seen miracles?
Yeah, I think I'd like to think that we see miracles every day. You know, I mean, I think we see patients who oftentimes who, you know, you think that, you know, they're not going to do as well, and they end up doing fantastically. And I think conversely, you see the other thing. I think, like we were talking about earlier, you see cases where you think everything is set up for this to be a chip shot, you know, for something that can be done with your eyes closed type of thing, and it doesn't go as well. So I think it is. I think it's really important to always have a perspective. And I think the key thing is never to get too high or too down on yourself with anything. I think at the end of the day, like with anything else, even on the business side of medicine, you know, you never get too thrilled when you feel you're really busy or too down when you don't feel you're busy enough. But you keep things in perspective and just do the right thing. And I think things kind of take care of themselves.
We're talking to Dr. J. Jagannathan. If you want to learn more, www.mi-neurosurgery.com. Doctor, let's fast forward to 2025.
Yep.
You're starting to gray in 2025, believe it or not. Describe for us what a spinal surgery will be like?
A couple of big areas, as we talked about. One is going to be stem cells, which is going to have an increasing role, not only in terms of fusions and things like that, but in terms of allowing the spine and the nerves to heal. And I think as we understand more about how damage occurs when you have narrowing or when you have injury to the spine, we'll be able to appreciate the role of stem cells and things like that better. I think the second major area is going to be on motion preserving technology. And by motion preserving, I mean that most of the time when we think of back surgery, particularly major surgeries now, we think of fusions, where you put in screws and rods and eliminate motion. And the new trend over the last 10 years or so has been to look more at preserving that motion in areas like artificial discs, what we call disc arthroplasty. There have been a number of studies in the U.S. on cervical disc arthroplasty, and I would say we probably do probably between 3 and 5 of those kind of cases every month, where patients who previously would have had to have fusions were able to treat and preserve their neck motion by using these artificial discs. Currently, they're only approved for 1 and 2 level cases in the neck by the FDA, and I imagine with time that level of approval will become larger as the technology becomes more advanced. Lumbar disc arthroplasty, or artificial lumbar disc, will be another major area. The results so far with lumbar disc arthroplasty has not been as good as with cervical disc arthroplasty, so these lumbar artificial discs still have some room to go in terms of having equipoise when it comes to comparing that to, you know, not doing anything or doing fusions. But I think that's where development and, you know, clinical trials and things like that come into play. And I think those will be the two major areas that we'll see advances in. And the third thing would be navigation, being able to navigate where we are in the spine, to reduce radiation exposure with x-rays and things like that for patients.
The future of robotic surgery.
Robotics is a rapidly emerging area in neurosurgery. It's interesting that I think neurosurgery has always been on the forefront when it comes to integrating technology with surgery. We've had computer-aided surgery where we're able to locate specific points in the brain using computer guidance. We're able to locate minute nucleuses in the brain for things like Parkinson's disease, for stimulation and things like that. So I think robotics is the next logical area where neurosurgery will grow. The level of precision that's involved in the brain or the spine for a robot to do the work is obviously extremely high. And unfortunately, in neurosurgery, we don't have that room for error. If you injure a nerve, the nerve is injured and a patient has a bad outcome. So it's going to take a lot of trials. There are two robotic systems for spine that are currently on the market. One of them is FDA approved. The other one, I think it's pending. I think one of them is being commercially released this year. So I think several major systems will probably be purchasing it. I think that's an area which will, you know, have a lot of hope for the future.
Dr. J, please keep letting God use you to help all of us.
Thank you very much.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahom.